Becoming a sniper was my long-cherished dream, since childhood in fact. And even now I can recall in minute detail scenes from the pre-war film Sniper. It was about the feats of a super-accurate Russian marksman in the First World War. In particular, I vividly remember the scenes from the film dealing with the art of camouflage. By making a replica of a tree stump or a dead horse and planting it in no man's land, a sniper could then climb into it and hit the enemy accurately from there. I want, through my narrative, to open up one more page in the history of the Great War for the Fatherland. To describe how the sniper's movement was born and grew to mass proportions in Leningrad and played a huge role in the positional trench warfare around the besieged city. Our academy commenced regular classes from morning till night. The cadets strove to acquire as quickly as possible all the tricks of the sniper's art, which Lieutenant Baturin willingly shared with us. And so we set off to take the examination. It was a gloomy October morning. The trenches had long been permeated with damp, and the cold at night had become more noticeable. The first significant amount of snow had fallen the previous day, straight onto the dry, frozen ground like a blanket, covering the crippled earth of Leningrad. We all realized that our first wartime winter would be very severe. My partner was Ivan Dobrik, a sturdy lad of short stature with a broad, good-natured face, but a perpetual sly expression on it. He was an excellent marksman on the smallest targets and a downright outstanding serviceman. A column of smoke from the stoves of the Nazi dugouts was rising high into the frosty sky, and steam was pouring out of the kitchens. Hungry as we were, it seemed to us that the Germans were being fed right round the clock. Through the telescopic sights of our rifles, we could see far into the depths of their defences, and German soldiers, large as life, both groups and individuals, occasionally wandering here and there, unfortunately, beyond the range of our bullets. We lay like that for a long time without taking a single shot, nestled up against the snow-covered parapet and closely pressed against each other. Lying in the frost for several hours on end without moving was not much fun, and we were not used to it. The frost went right through us. We so wanted to get up and warm our frozen feet and hands with some vigorous movement, but we knew this was impossible. We were in a lousy mood. It began to get dark. Suddenly, I noticed some moving targets in my firing sector, about 60 meters from our observation point. "Ivan, take a look. I can see some Nazis on the right," I cried out joyfully, completely forgetting that I was only about 80 meters from the enemy front line and could become a target myself. "I'll take the last one, then the first one." Dobrik had spotted the Nazis too. "Don't let them get away, Yevgeny." Making the usual adjustments to allow for crosswind and the movement of the target, I set my sights on the head of the last of the three Nazis and, holding my breath, smoothly pressed the trigger. The sound of a sniper's bullet is not loud, but its sting is lethal. I barely caught the sound of my shot. My own heart was thumping much more loudly, it seemed to me. I saw the last of the Germans sink down. The other two continued on their way without noticing what had happened. Cheered by my success, I decided to shoot the second Nazi. The second conqueror also fell, as if he had tripped. However, he must have had time to yell something, because the first soldier, who had taken two of three further steps forward, stopped, looked around, and went back up to his fallen companion. He stood over him, gesticulating with his hands and saying something to the soldier lying immobile. He was possibly ticking him off for his clumsiness, or more likely suggesting that he get back on his feet, still failing to guess what had actually happened and certainly not expecting what would happen a second later. I had more than enough time to reload the rifle and take another shot. It made a sharp crack, as if a woodpecker had struck a dry fir tree with its sturdy beak. And felled by my bullet, the third Nazi collapsed dead on top of the second. A sniper has many enemies, especially in the summer. Apart from the main one, the enemy, there are others from whom you can never know what to expect. They can be bees, wasps, flies, ants, and even field mice. I remember once on a fine summer's day, Ivan Dobrik and I were lying in ambush. We had to lie out in no man's land, in thick grass in a flat, open area, almost right under the enemy's noses. We conducted observations of the German front line and the approaches to it, having correctly calculated that, in thick grass in a flat field without a single landmark, it would be difficult for the Nazis to spot us. We would have lain there calmly till darkness fell, but for pure chance. My partner, lying motionless in the baking sun, suddenly became an object of interest to a tiny field mouse. How this curious daredevil got past his tightly fastened belt into Ivan's tunic, I still cannot understand. While the mouse was crawling around somewhere on his back, Ivan managed to put up with it, being afraid to move. But when it ventured lower down, onto his stomach and began to nip him, Dobrik's patience snapped. He suddenly bellowed across the whole of no man's land and began laughing hysterically. I was seriously afraid. He had discarded his rifle and was rolling around on the grass and yelling with a heartrending voice, "What's up, Ivan? Are you out of your mind? There are Germans right next to us. They'll spray us any minute now," I said in bewilderment. The whole situation and the expression on Ivan's face as he continued to roll around in the grass put me in a foolishly merry mood. I too began to laugh. Of course, the Nazis were not slow to open fire with mortars. "Let's run for it." Ivan could barely utter the words through tears of laughter, and grabbing his rifle he darted towards our trenches, pressing one hand to a wound he'd only just suffered as he went. "You've put on quite a show," said the observer, escorting Ivan and me under cover. "Have you turned into a couple of half-wits, or what?" The constant bombing raids, the continuous artillery fire, the pursuit of enemy snipers, the possibility that any second you could become a target yourself for an equally experienced German marksman, or perish from a stray bullet or an enemy shell or mortar fragment, all made for constant tension. At night, when we were off duty, I used to go and see my friend and fellow townsman, Vlad Dudin, our company sergeant major. Vlad and I had no trouble finding things to talk about. By the light of a homemade oil lamp fueled by low-grade petrol or fat, we would recall the distant and precious days of peacetime. And of course, we recalled our hometown of Tambov, our traumatically short youth, our home, kith and kin. One time we became so involved in our conversation that dawn had already broken beyond the dugout's closed door. We were reminded of it by our regimental wit and master of sarcasm, Vlad Kozirev. Bursting into the dugout, Kozirev shouted at us from the doorway, his eyes sticking out of his head. "What are you sitting there for, gabbling nonsense, when the Nazis have played such a filthy trick on us?" "What sort of trick?" asked Dudin in irritation, expecting, as usual from Kozirev, another prank or practical joke. "The Germans have put up a plywood sign with nasty slogans against us. What are you going to do?" We got to the front line, and indeed, on top of a German dugout stood a plywood sign on narrow poles thrust into the snow. Inscribed on it, with charcoal in big letters, was, "Greetings, citizen, come over to our side," in ungrammatical Russian. I settled comfortably into my deep-dug firing position. My observation point was well camouflaged on the side facing the enemy, and nothing was likely to be detected from above. Our troops had long been instructed in the art of camouflage, especially we snipers. It is no secret that the casual, slack, and careless do not survive on the front. Indecisively, cautiously, as if concerned that his appearance would set machine guns rattling and cause people to die, the sun glanced out. It was now quite light. I had been studying the enemy defences for a long time, the German dugouts. Now and again, someone would pass by near them, cautiously stooped over. They didn't need to worry. It wasn't them that interested me today. I took a look to the rear. According to what our scouts had told me, their headquarters ought to be somewhere there. Earlier on, any Nazi headquarters was easy to distinguish by the telephone lines. Now the Germans had become more careful. They'd begun to run the wires along the ground and cover them with snow. The main thing was the sentry walking back and forth by their dugout. "Looks like that's the headquarters," I thought to myself, and finally switched all my attention to it. I estimated that it was roughly 700 meters away, but estimating distance by eye is one thing. It needed to be checked. I set my sights at 700 meters and loaded the rifle with a tracer cartridge. I chose a moment when the machine guns were chattering on the edge of the front line, and covered by their noise, took a single shot. The bullet left a clear trace in the door. Everything was precisely worked out. Now it only remained to make a slight adjustment to the sight's drum, and await the kill. I caught sight of three Nazis leaving the white heap of the dugout. One of them was naked to the waist, while the other two were minus overcoats, just in uniforms. Raising up his arms, the half-naked one began to walk around. Bastard, he's come out to do his exercises, I guessed. The other two began to wash their faces with snow. Waiting for the moment when the semi-naked man finally stopped and began to do some squats, I took my first shot. The Nazi squatted and collapsed onto the snow and lay down, as if he was going to sunbathe, glad to see the bright sun. One of the other men turned, looked at the lying man, and apparently said something to the other. He turned round. They both stood there and looked at the man spread out on the snow, then went up and began to lift him up. Then, realizing what was up, they started looking round, perplexed, not realizing where the bullet had come from. They didn't even look at our trenches, apparently thinking the distance was too far. I didn't allow them to ponder for too long, and skewered both of them. And hardly had I got ready to fire again when I saw a motorbike and sidecar approaching the headquarters dugout. The motorcyclist rode up and stopped dead by the door itself. A tall German jumped from the pillion in no time at all and began to assist a fat Nazi to get out of the sidecar. While he was obligingly fiddling round with this person of seemingly important rank, I focused on the rider, who had leaned forward to rest on the handlebars. I fired. The tall man had turned to the motorcyclist, wishing, I thought, to command him to leave, but seeing that he was apparently asleep over the handlebars, gave him a nudge. In vain, however. After my shot, the tall man also fell backwards behind the motorcyclist, waving his arms. Enthusiasm is all very well, but the voice of reason was still telling me, "Enough for today, you can't stay in one place for so long, they'll get you." I settled down into my deep little foxhole. There wasn't much room in there and I was terribly thirsty. I felt the urge for a little sleep. The extra nervous tension had seemingly had an effect. So what? I can relax a little bit. But I had scarcely closed my eyes before a shell whistled past and exploded somewhere nearby. Leaping up immediately, I looked out of the trench and saw 300 meters away huge clumps of earth settling back from on high. Several minutes later, I once again heard the whistle of a flying shell. It grew in volume. The explosion forced me to stoop down lower in my foxhole. This shell fell about 100 meters away from me and closer to the tram lines. Clearly, the gunners were aiming for me, but I never got to hear the next explosion. The next exploding shell tossed up fresh tons of earth. A huge clump the size of a cauldron lid covered me in my firing niche, landing heavily on my back. "It's all over," the thought raced through my mind. "I'll never dig my way out. I've got no more strength left, and something's weighing down heavily on me, in my ears, in my mouth, up my nose." Again, some blunt object landed on the ground and something heavy struck me on the head and rolled onto my shoulders. Then, there was total silence. Darkness descended, and I could think no more. I came to an hour company command post in a vast concrete pipe laid across the tram line and right under it. I was sitting on a stool with my back leaning against the pipe. Some people were walking around me. I sort of recognized them and didn't recognize them. Everything was in a fog. Maybe I've gone deaf, I thought. As they told me later, I slept at the command post for 18 hours uninterrupted, slept as I sat there. "Dear Mum, I'm not hiding anything. Honestly, I'm alive and well, safe and unharmed. First, I must tell you that Vlad Dudin and I are now on rest and recreation in the rear. It's a kind of gratuity for us. For example, I recently wiped out 11 Nazis in a day, and now I've been rewarded. Yesterday, a scout I know dropped by in passing and said that 3 days ago our troops had captured an important Nazi. At interrogation, this man told us, 'One of your snipers killed 11 gallant soldiers of our Reich in 2 hours. One was a general.' So now my tally includes a general as well. So you see, I am truthfully reporting my activities at the front. Now I'm waiting for your report on life and work. Yevgeny." December was a harsh month. The winter of 1941 to 1942 has remained in everyone's memory. It came early, and it was ferocious. The winter months became a difficult test for both of us, the defenders of Leningrad, and for its residents. Unsettled by their heavy losses, the German command was compelled to call in troops urgently from other fronts and direct their super sharpshooters against Leningrad. So, aces like this, expert masters of their craft, killers with seniority and huge experience, appeared in our area too. We quickly felt the presence of these Nazi snipers. They would fire through the slit of a pillbox and skillfully take out our observers. I resolved to test myself against one of the Nazi ace snipers who had appeared in our sector. By tracking the path of the Nazis' shots back to their point of origin, I came to the conclusion that he was sitting somewhere close to the tram lines, in the broad expanse in front of our 3rd platoon, to the right of it and closer to the Gulf of Finland, in no man's land. And so, clad in a snow-white camouflage smock over my regular clothes, I crawled in that direction, one dark and frosty night. By first light, I was already lying in no man's land, well camouflaged in the deep snow. I was not concerned about concealment, but would I succeed in spotting the enemy? He would also be camouflaged against the same snow, one imagined, just as well as I was. And so, I waited. However, it all turned out differently. Suddenly, I noticed against the pure, eye-testingly white snow, a suspicious little spot of something coloured differently from snow had appeared. And thus, while pondering and trying to explain the reason for this spot, I lost sight of the most important thing, the thing I had been freezing so long for. But it all turned out to be very simple. Beside this little spot on the surface, a big one suddenly appeared, in white camouflage. In a trice, it crept up a couple of meters to the left and disappeared as if swallowed by the earth. From the unexpected nature of it all and being chilled to the bone, I didn't even manage a shot. They literally carried me in their arms to the dugout, as my feet had refused to move. They were frozen and, it appeared, frostbitten. Contact with hard surface caused intolerable pain. But once again, my friends came to the rescue. They took my footwear off in the dugout and began to rub my feet with snow and woolen gloves until I felt some pinpricks. The battalion medical assistant was consulted. "Oh dear, no brains," he said reproachfully. "You should have smeared your feet with fat before you went out, wrapped them in newspaper, and only then wound on your foot wrappings." "Well," I responded, "I'll do everything scientifically tomorrow. But today, just rub them. Make an effort, be a friend." In the morning, I was awakened by the company sentry. "It's time. Up you get." "What, already? What a pleasant dream you've interrupted. I was dreaming of my mother. We were buying rye flat cakes, hot and fragrant." "Did you get to try one?" asked the sentry. "He didn't give me a chance," I answered, closing my eyes again. "Enough, Betty by Nikolaev. You'll miss your Nazi." That I was facing an experienced foe, there could be no doubt. Just as it could not be doubted that he was already in situ. "He's outwitted me, the bastard. Got there earlier," I thought, when first light had already dawned. Tears began to form in my eyes from the continuous observation of a single point through telescopic sights. It was the wind blowing straight into my face and the frost. I kept brushing away the tears while trying not to make any obvious movements. The fingers of my right hand, which were constantly ready for action, had frozen, and I began to worry as to whether I would be able to hit the target when necessary. I realized that in duels like this, there were no wounded. A sniper only ever makes a single mistake. I had not taken a shot in over a week, and he had noticed that and was being careful. I didn't have time to complete my thought when suddenly something seemed to prod me in the very heart, and with good reason. The head of the Nazi had appeared from out of a trench above the snowy covering. All at once, I felt hot. Now, just like yesterday, he would drag his large body out of the trench onto the surface, swiftly cover the 3 meters distance, and be off. "No, you must be joking, you rat. It won't work this time." And I firmly grasped the rifle in my hands. The Nazi's face, firmly held in the sights of my rifle, was distinctly visible through the eyepiece. He did not even glance in my direction. I had to bring him down and show everyone that he was lying fallen on our land, and I was almost certain that any second now he would leap out. He was bound to repeat his maneuver from yesterday, only now I knew about it and was expecting it. Unsettled by the silence around and hurried along by the intensifying frost and gathering darkness, with one short jump, the Nazi landed up on the surface of the ground. Stooping low, he managed to take his first and last step. The shot, long awaited on our sector, resounded. Like the crack of a whip echoing in the frosty air, it brought the Nazi down onto the snow. His rifle, now a danger no longer to our troops, slipped out of his hands and fell at the feet of its dead owner. At the end of 1942, I was transferred to counterintelligence and my sniper's score was cut off at the total of 324. Having liberated Leningrad from the enemy siege, our division, along with other units of the Leningrad Front, pressed forward, drove the Nazis back, and reached their actual den. Travelling the entire route with me was my sniper's rifle, the butt of which still bears the 3 large, 2 medium-sized, and 4 small stars traced on it during the war years.